I guess we should start it, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for coming to the podcast, Taylor.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Take our bar conversations to the mic.
Yeah, I think, and I guess let's start with discussing how we get to know each other by discussing Russian literature.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Because for me, Russian, it's very impressive that you read a lot of Russian literature, especially Dostoevsky, which, you know, has a special place in my heart, so to speak. And for me, it's like interesting if, like, once you read, like, for example, like Dostoevsky is like, you know, it's Russian classics.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people say that he has, like, he embodies something or he in his writing, so to speak.
Like the Russian spirit?
Yeah. And I think it's, to an extent, it's really true, because certain things about Russian society that didn't even change that much that he, like, depicts in his writings. And I'm curious what you have to say in the sense, how do you see Russia, like, through, like, writings of, you know, Russian writers that you read?
I mean, I think it's a very direct confrontation with the suffering of life, like a very open mm-hmm. acknowledgement of it in his mm-hmm. works. But I think through that, though, at least my interpretation, there's a large amount of understanding for the awful things that someone may do in that situation because of their environment. So, you know,
yeah.
Go to Crime and Punishment. Spoiler alert, I guess it's whatever. Yeah. You know, Raskolnikov, who commits an awful crime, you know, but he contextualizes it for you. He doesn't justify it. He still condemns it.
Yeah, yeah.
But he pushes you to critically think so much as to why this happened.
Yeah.
And I found that to be, I don't know, very, very revealing. You know, he makes Raskolnikov a very admirable character, explicitly states that he's intelligent, you know, good looking, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see the noble intentions as to why he commits such an act.
Yeah.
But still condemns it. And then, you know, there's a bigger political context to it as well. You know, you talk about the extraordinary man who can transcend moral boundaries if it's for the greater good.
Like, yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of like a utilitarian idea.
Almost. Yeah.
And I feel like some of those ideas influenced the Russian Revolution that was upcoming as well. To an extent.
Or at least he depicted some, like, the beginnings of what would follow, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
during, like, Russian, like not one, like, two revolutions, basically, not even two, like, even more revolutions that followed. But for me, it's also interesting how do you perceive, like, this nation and this spirit that, like, you know, for example, Dostoevsky embodies, or, like, other authors, they try to... Because they always try to say, I mean, obviously they try to say there's something unique. I mean, especially Dostoevsky, because he played a lot with this idea of Russian spirit.
Mm-hmm.
He was, like, very, I would say, cognizant of this idea that, you know, Russia is kind of, I mean, it is a European country, but it has, like, this unique characteristic. And he tried to, I guess, portray it in his own writings.
Mm-hmm.
And just for me, it's, like, always... It's always interesting because you've never like visited Russia, right?
No, absolutely not. Yeah. No,
I bet you really would like to go there.
Yeah, one day I'd like to see Moscow before I die, but that's indefinitely postponed.
Yeah,
I ain't a fool. Yeah. I ain't going there right now. But it's certainly interesting, and I think also the way he's able to articulate the irrationality of human nature at large. Because, you know, I know you're asking me about the Russian spirit in general. Like, how does it make me perceive Russia specifically?
Yeah.
But I find something very universal in his work. Like, I forget the whole quote, but from Notes of Underground, how he says, you know, he basically says a man will do something against his own interest just to prove to himself that he's not a piano key.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, maybe some people, you know, people listen to this aren't going to like it, but, you know, I think about COVID, you know, people who did not take the vaccine, you know, and I kind of feel like there wasn't really no rational basis for that.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I think it was kind of just a way of them asserting their own, I don't know, their agency.
Yeah, just, you know, to show that they have some...
Yeah, because, I mean, we don't want to get too sidetracked. But, you know, of course, some people had concerns about, you know, the side effects that it could give you, the vaccine. You know, for some people, it's very valid. But, you know, sometimes people would say that, and I'm wondering, okay, you want to run with the side effects of that? Or the side effects of what COVID could do?
Yeah.
Instead, like, again, this irrational...
element.
Yeah. So he takes that very head on and articulates in a way that I had never seen before leading up to when I... first record, which was Crime and Punishment, actually.
Yeah.
And then I was hooked, basically, from there on out.
But he's also, he's just a good author.
Like, absolutely.
I guess what people, I mean, a lot of people now, I mean, obviously Dostoevsky is a very important like persona in modern literature and philosophy. And people tend to think that he's like, yeah, he's just like this like very smart type of philosopher, type of dude, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, first of all, he's just a brilliant writer.
Absolutely.
I mean, of course, something like probably lost in translation. But like you can say, like in Russian, when you read him, like the way he depicts, like, you know, like minute details of the scene, it's just like they're so perfect. And like how he depicts like intentions and like, you know, how people always do stuff, but they're always kind of, they don't know what exactly they want to do, or it's how for like just like small gestures they can express certain feelings or emotions, which is brilliant. Like, you know, and you see it like in people after you read, like you read him.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, I think about actually, I'm getting the author mixed up, but Tolstoy, I think, has some of the same
talents. Yeah.
Or, you know, Anna Karenina, and I actually forget the name of this major character, but basically describing how, you know, he has a certain set of political beliefs simply because they align with what he would like to do in his day-to-day life.
Yeah.
You know, it fits a certain lifestyle that he just wants to live on at just a solely individual level, yeah, like from a selfish point of view. But he rationalizes them to himself as if they're for the greater good.
Yeah.
And I just... Again, like you said, you see it in people all the time after you read.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, they certainly, I mean, Dostoevsky especially was like a, I guess they call him like the first psychoanalyst of like 19th century. And the way he depicts like the inner dialogues and inner thinking. Like to me, I mean, I read like all Dostoevsky. So, I mean, I read like all his books when I was very, very young. And it was hell of impressive, like, you know, how you can just go into the world of inner world and just create like those type of like, you know, stories from just basically people on like based on people's like perceptions and emotions. And then, you know, create those beautiful narratives. Brilliant. So, I mean, he's a brilliant writer. I mean, so, you know,
and this is something I've seen other people mention before, but I'll just say it again. The way that he'll create characters who represent ideas that he strongly disagrees with, but he makes their arguments so strong in themselves, which forces you to critically analyze and doubt them, and you kind of come out with an even stronger belief in terms of what Dostoevsky wants you to think in certain situations. But
he was also very religious.
I guess the Christian nationalism is definitely in the writing.
You can see. I mean, all his stories, they have like the Bible narrative, so to speak. Mm-hmm. One has to just be very, like, you know, if you know the Bible, you probably can connect the dots, so to speak. But I mean, you know, like, what do you think about the idea? Because I mean, I've heard a couple of times that, you know, people want to kind of prohibit Russian culture, like including like Dostoevsky, for example. Do you have any thoughts on this? Because, you know, sometimes people, I mean, I've been asked a couple of times whether, you know, it's a kind of good idea to, because, you know, Russian culture embodies like imperialism and stuff like this.
Yeah, but I mean, I disagree with the idea that it inherently embodies imperialism.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, there's geographic reasons for that as well. You know, if Peter the Great had not been able to go all the way out to the east, to the Pacific, you know, would they have still had those imperial intentions? I mean, that's counterfactual, but I don't think there's anything inherent in the Russian culture that's imperial or negative. It's simply a culture. So I guess your question is, how do I feel? You're speaking the context of in the West, like not teaching. I completely disagree with that. Full face. Of course, if it's some sort of like far right ideology or far, you know, left in a way that's, in a way that's going to cause unnecessary violence or harm to people masquerading behind something that pretends to represent the Russian culture.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, I disagree with that. But I mean, talking about Dostoevsky, you know, or whatever. I mean, that's art.
Yeah.
Especially if we're talking about this, it's literature, it's art. So even with the flaws that's in it, like, because Dostoevsky, I mean, you can see the anti-Semitism in his work as well.
Yeah.
So I don't think when it comes to the main morals of his works, the point, I would not say it's censored. I mean, course not, I'm not anti-Semite, but I mean, in certain ways he refers to Jewish characters within his books. I mean, you see it there, and it, you know, it should be acknowledged, like on paper over that, but you also take in the context of, you know, of that time, you know, Russia. Russia has a lot of anti-Semitism, I think, to this day, unfortunately. I mean, it's a problem globally, but I definitely would not.
But do you think just like reading Dostoevsky now, it gives you a certain perspective on even on Russia of today?
It's hard for me to answer that because I ain't seen Russia myself.
Yeah.
Like we just been over, I've never been there. I think you're actually the first like Russian person I've had extended conversations with on a consistent basis. Yeah. I don't think you're the first Russian I've spoke to.
Okay.
But, you know, especially when we talk about getting into politics and culture and all that. So to be honest, I simply don't feel informed enough to say, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, I think about what's going on now with the war. But at least at this moment, I don't see any direct connection. I mean, I guess maybe I would maybe go for like the psychological perspective, but it's just...
But I think you can actually... I mean, I would maybe give a tip. If you think through suffering... Which, I mean, obviously, it's embodied both in Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. I mean, it's embodied in, like, whole corpus of, like, Russian literature of 19th century. But I feel it's the same suffering right now. It's, like, it's always, like, Russian people, they always live for this, like, what I call it's, like, idea that things can be better, like, could potentially be better. But you understand, like, you know, they cannot, I mean, they wouldn't improve, so to speak. It's, like, this, like, distorted reality when you...
So it's cognitive dissonance, it almost sounds like what you're describing. Two ideas, believing two contradictory ideas at once.
Because you can see it like in day-to-day conversations, because like when you talk to people in Russia, you hardly find anyone, even people who like, you know, publicly like support Putin. You see like in private conversations how they, you know, they understand the absurdity of the whole situation. Mm. They understand like, you know, like how bad things look like. But yet they kind of like, there's nothing for them to do, so to speak, you know. So it's like there's a lot of suffering because you have to always compromise, you know, with reality. And I've seen it like on so many personal occasions when people just, you know, they just go and live their life. They just cannot really make the moral choice. I mean, they understand that there is a moral choice to be made, maybe. Mm-hmm. But there is just life that you need to live, you know, so to speak. And there is like this, and it just you can see it only amplifies the suffering, you know, of the people. So I guess that's like if you read Dostoevsky, you can definitely see, because like they're always like, you know, even in Dostoevsky, what impresses me the most, people are so conscious about that things can get so much better in Russia. Like, you know, they always discuss democracy in Europe.
Yeah, there was the reforms in the Western Europe. It's like, oh, should we copy them? Because I feel like, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, a lot of Russian aristocrats spoke French at this time.
There
was definitely an affinity for Europe, however you want to neatly define that. But then as certain, you know, reforms took place towards the end of the, you know, 1800s, it's like, okay, which way are we going to go? Are we going to go our own path? And obviously they went. Well, I mean, actually, communism is a European, very European idea. But yeah, I mean, that's insightful when you told me that. Yeah, of course, I didn't see that myself, but... Yeah, I don't know. It's a whole lot to chew with. It's a whole lot to chew with Dostoevsky. I feel like a lot of what I got from him actually was very psychological.
Yeah.
And I guess universal in terms of people around me, but also within myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess suppose as I gain more knowledge about Russia, maybe I'll see more trends as time goes on.
Yeah. I mean, it's just from also my personal observations that you see now. I mean, it's just such a big part of Russian society. And then, of course, there is all sorts of... It creates all sorts of, like, almost master narratives that, you know, eventually Russian people, they even, like, they embody suffering and they even love to suffer to a certain extent. I mean, it's as paradoxical as it sounds. They kind of, like, embrace the suffering. It's a little bit of a stoic narrative, like, you know. So it creates all those type of, like, narratives. Like, people really, like just regular people, they really kind of believe in those narratives. Or they kind of, like, when they... operate, that's how they explain their own thinking. It's like they just explain, you know, I mean, we all understand that, like, you know, Putin is just like, you know, he's just like a badass, he's just like a monarch now, but like, we, you know, like, we're just peasants here, like, you know,
what can we do,
like, is like the narrative that is really, I mean, it's really prominent.
This idea that, I mean, it's just completely out of their hands.
I
find that hard to grasp coming from my perspective, but it's clearly evident, and this is something I've mentioned to you before, but I'll say it again, is I do feel like part of the reason you know, maybe not as many Russians are saying something that do have negative feelings towards this war and Putin at large. You know, to really speak up and say something would be an acknowledgement that this mentality that they've taken through a lot of their lives has ended in disaster. You know, in terms of, you know, what it's led to, the war.
Yeah.
And the negative effects for Russia itself as well, you know.
Yeah.
Young men dying for what?
Yeah.
You know.
But I guess that's just this kind of disconnect that, like, for me, it's, I mean, for me, of course, it's interesting because in comparison to the US, I mean, Russian authorities, they were never accountable. Like, you know, it's like they kind of exist, like, because, I mean, obviously, like, you know, there was like a Tsarist Russia, there was like a communist Russia, and then was like a modern Russia, which, you know, played around like with ideas of democracy in the 90s and kind of failed. Like, you know, there were like a lot of undemocratic things happening already in the 90s. But like eventually it came down to like, you know, a strong leader in necessity. And there's like, there's no kind of mechanism for Russian people to kind of like control those people because it's just kind of...
Yeah, from an institutional perspective.
Yeah. And I can also see it's like, you know, it's so symbolic how like, for, like, you know, Russian elites leave, for example, they live in those like near Moscow. They all, it's like, I mean, we have like kind of...
The dachas? The dachas?
Yeah, and it's like a super secretive, like, you know, super secluded areas with like fences that are literally 5 meters tall. Like, imagine seeing a fence that you cannot. It's not that you don't see the like house; you don't even see like what's there. Mm-hmm. It's like it's literally fence, like, you know, like almost like a house. And this is like, I mean, and for me, it's also interesting because I try to think a lot through this perspective of kind of physical embodiment of power. How it like shows you a lot because, you know, it shows you that there's such a disconnect from a small bureaucrats to big bureaucrats. Yeah. That's how they kind of operate. But that's how things happen, so to speak.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously there is, you know, as we discussed many times, there's like this always a conjuncture that Russia tries to create its path. And then kind of like chooses like this unique
path. But what I do want to ask you while you're bringing that up is, you know, the 90s and the paths that could have been taken, what was taken in terms of the shock therapy that Russia went through in the 90s. I mean, do you feel like, you know, the transition to capitalism was for the best, but it was done into harsh and rash a manner? Yeah. Do you think that was the only option given to y'all? I mean,
yeah.
Because, I mean, it seems pretty objective that the 90s was not a good time for Russia.
Oh, yeah, it was, like, probably the worst time.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how true this is, but I've seen some statistics that for Russia individually, like, what they went through in the 90s was akin to what some parts of the world went through in the Great Depression.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an exaggeration, but it seems
real bad. Yeah, I mean, even from personal experience, yeah, like, things were, like, super bad. It's like people literally didn't have like, you know, capacity to earn money because there was like nothing, like there was no, like there were no jobs, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
and all like, the assets were kind of sold in these backroom deals, these big companies,
yeah,
you know, that weren't available to the average person.
Yeah, there were like food shortages, there was mafia, there was like all sorts of like stuff happening at the same time. So it was like the whole situation was a complete disaster, so to speak, right? And I mean, yeah, it's a very obviously very interesting now period of time in Russian history. I mean, I think things could have been established it could have been done better, but it's also like hard for me to say. I mean, I didn't live through '90s. I was born in '90s, but I didn't. Live
yeah, you were conscious.
Yeah, you know. So for me, it's just.
Yeah, I just also think it's interesting to bring up because I do think maybe that time is part of the reason why some people have such a strong affinity for Putin. You know, they see him as a bringer of stability.
Yeah.
Now, maybe not so much the case since the war.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess this kind of leads to, you know, what you sent me, your paper, on how NATO itself played a role in leading to this war and Russia's attitudes towards NATO. Of course, NATO's internal logics itself. But, I did want to ask you, I mean, do you, what value do you place on other international institutions in terms of, you know, motives for Russia starting the war, for example, like the EU? Because, I mean, what I, you know, something I thought while I was reading it was, you know, Russia invades Crimea after Ukraine signs the association agreement with the EU in 2014. And from your paper, again, it centers NATO as being a, you know, a center reasoning for as to why this war took place. Not saying that Russia had no responsibility, but that's what the argument was over. But I also think there was a 6-year gap between the Munich conference and this invasion of 2014. I believe it was the Bucharest.
Oh, I mean, the speech was in Munich, yeah.
But I'm thinking about in 2008 when the US basically said Ukraine will join NATO.
Yeah, yeah.
But on a ambiguous timeline.
Yeah, like without time frame, you know. Exactly. Just like they just stated that Ukraine would join NATO.
And so what I'm getting to is, what explanation do you see for that 6-year gap between 2008 and 2014? You know.
I think it's in, I now kind of do research on the periods from 2000 to 2008, so to speak, which is also a very interesting period. And I think the explanation is that they just waited for something to happen. For example, even in 2008, like you remember I discussed in my paper, like this treaty that they sent to Washington and Brussels. Like they sent, well, not exactly the same treaty, but they created, like when Medvedev came to power, they sent a treaty on European security, or was like a charter on European security, which kind of the same thing that they did in 2000, like in 2021, which is like they just proposed the same kind of thing, you know, basically no expansion of NATO, like the security for the whole continent, including Russia and stuff like this. I think that they really waited like a long time, which, you know, it sounds like, you know, when you do empirical research and you come to these conclusions and those conclusions align with like what kind of Russian propaganda has to say about it, you always feel awkward. You know?
Because Putin's been very clear. He really makes his a lot about NATO. And then the Ukrainian Nazis.
But I guess this is like, you know, I mean, Ukrainian Nazis is obviously something that they needed to create for internal audience.
Yeah, because they want to compare it to the Great Patriotic War, World War II.
Yeah.
You know, they're really trying hard to make that, create that parallel in the Russian psyche of the people in order to justify it. Hey, you know, the Germans are sending weapons to kill us again.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
That's very, very clear. NATO's been a big piece of Russian propaganda.
Yeah, but I think there is something to this thinking that is like, again, like this strategic and you can say like military security perspective that they like did pursue for very like for, I mean, from like 2000 to 2000, I would say three, they basically pursued European integration, like an awesome Euro-Atlantic integration, like Russia itself pursued it. And like you could see through speeches of Putin, like, you know, Ukraine now says, like in my paper, that it's like the path to NATO is irreversible. It's like the same thing Russia said to America. It's like for 3 years, but then they kind of dropped it because of Iraq war and stuff like this, which is to me interesting because I think it's the whole kind of puzzle as I look at it. It's like, because like the US never actually thought like, okay, what's the role of Russia in this whole kind of European security thing? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like, because the US did have all the power in the world to do whatever they wanted. So, and I guess Russia just, what Russia wanted from them is just like to create this kind of like super ally, like this, like a special type of like almost not an American representative, but maybe something like to play on the Russian, on, I guess, to play with the Russian psyche, because Russian people, they always like kind of try to pursue, they have like this, you know, pursuit of greatness. And I guess they just waited just kind of like they wanted to see what would happen, so to speak.
It was definitely a moment of instability and weakness on Ukraine's part. I mean, you literally have a revolution
in
the country. You know, the president flees
the
country, you know. New elections take place, the new person takes power, audio in the context of widespread protests.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, from that perspective, it makes a certain amount of sense. I guess maybe that was the moment they were waiting for. But I do wonder, because where I was kind of going with it as well is, you know, with the association agreement with the EU, which in comparison to Russia is a more democratic institution. The EU's dirty laundry we could air out in a whole other conversation, but I don't want to get too sidetracked. Yeah. But what I'm getting is I wonder, you know, how threatened did he feel by the concept of a Slavic democracy on his border?
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, that's automatically, you know, incongruous with what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess you could say he doesn't necessarily have to feel threatened, but, you know, again, a Slavic country as well with a lot of common cultural traits with Russia, at least that's my understanding. I don't know how true that is, the Russian-Ukrainian, but I'm just saying in terms of familiarity, I'm not an expert on the subject. I'm just stating my uninformed opinion. But I do wonder how much of that played into it. You know, I
think it's... I mean, it's like Ukraine is definitely part of Russian psyche and has always been...
like, that's still ours? Would you say that mentality is still prevalent?
I think that's
paternal mentality.
Yeah.
That we know what's best for them, you know, or don't rock the boat too much.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely...
At least at the higher levels of leadership.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I guess it's like, because of, it's like you either want to think about it, I guess, like in very abstract terms, and meaning that you want to think about this issue. I mean, I would really try to separate this issue into kind of certain levels, because you can think, of course, abstractly through perspective of like security issues, like you know, like just pure geopolitics maybe. Or we can think about it through perspective of mass psyche, like, you know, how people perceive Ukraine and Russia. Yeah, they perceive it's like it's not a real country. That's not a
common belief. So Putin was striking a tone that was resonated with people when he what he really describes is that, you know, a lot of Ukrainians, of course, is propaganda. I'm not condoning this viewpoint, but this idea that Ukrainians are suffering from false consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
That they're really Russians and they don't realize it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. And so that, you know, I just is something that I don't think can be understated in terms of explanations for the war. And then also, you know, going back to 2004, I believe, when Yushchenko, who was the more pro-EU, pro-West candidate, was poisoned at a dinner.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah.
And, you know, one of those guys fled to Russia. And then he actually came back to Ukraine in 2012, I believe. He wasn't immediately exiled by Russia. But there's... You know, there's been a track record, I think, of interference, clearly,
in
Ukrainian affairs leading up to this war. And just the way they went about it with Ukraine, it is very imperial, thuggish, gangsterish. You know, a lot of which, you know, you see how the U.S. has treated the Caribbean, Latin America.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's still kind of in a different... They do it differently, so to speak, right? From, like, this moral standpoint, sometimes. I mean, nowadays, right? Nowadays, when they went to Iraq or Libya, that's for, like, to protect democracy. I mean, yeah. But I mean, sometimes you just, like, wonder, like, whether you really... I mean, but I sometimes I just don't... Also, when you follow people in White House, I mean, they can't believe in what they're doing, you know? The other question is, like, how does it come into reality that their, like, you know, again, actions contradict their own thinking, and they consistently do it? Because, I mean, at a certain point, because, you know, Russians think that Americans are just very, like, American leadership, right? Not American people, but, like, American leadership is just very cynical. So whatever they're doing, they're not really doing for the sake of, you know, democratizing, like, you know, the world, or just like for their own.
They're always looking for the motivation behind the pretext.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's just saying it's like they're cynical. You know, whatever they're doing is kind of like, I mean, they're doing what the US blames the Russia for, you know, kind of thinking. And I mean, I doubt that that's the case. You know, I doubt that, like, the US is just a very cynical nation, just doing, because, like, also knowing a lot about, you know, American history and the whole, just the creation of the US. It's just like, since the beginning, it was nation, like, completely, like kind of based on this ideology, you know, and it's like very prominent. And most people who who work in, like, especially in the US government, I think they believe in this ideal. I mean, they believe what they're doing. You know what I mean? At least for me, how it seems from the outside. Maybe you can help me here in the sense of how do you think about people in the White House? I don't know.
I mean, how I think about the people in the White House. No, it's like Pandora's box.
No, for me, it's interesting because when I, like, for example, for me, when I think about Putin, I definitely think that, you know, he came to power, and you can find those videos online when he talks about, like, the necessity of democracy. You know, they ask him about, like, and he used, like, a famous video when they ask him something about democracy, and he says, like, yeah, it's like if one person stays in power, it corrupts you, you know, it, like, and mm-hmm. it's like a detriment to democracy. And he says it, like, I mean, again, it's like also, like, it just gives you the perspective that, of course, he was self-aware of those things, right? Mm-hmm. And he gives interviews, like, discussing this openly. And then, like, you know, like, you know, years pass by, and, like, you can see him, like, you know, coming to Kremlin, and, like, you know, and Kremlin is, it's like, I mean, if you see the pictures, that you cannot really, I mean, it's like certain things you cannot really see on the picture, right? When mm-hmm. you see, like, the physical Kremlin, and it looks like this, I mean, grand European palace, it has, like, yeah, it does have, like, those kind of, like, influence from the Middle East, so to speak, right? The whole, like, the architecture. And, like, you know, imagine him going through those kind of rooms, like, day after day. And then just starting to, like, I definitely think, like, those ideas creeped into him. The ideas of the greatness of Russia, mm-hmm. you know, of Russian sovereignty. Because, like,
A special mission.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think you can go through those palaces and not get, like, you know, infected by this idea that Russia is, like, a superpower. Yeah.
Well, in general, I believe absolute power corrupts absolutely, like I said, in a general way. I think,
yeah.
Could I give you the exact number? No, not for sure. I don't know, maybe a decade mm-hmm. plus. But, I mean, I think, you know, if you have power over a certain period of time, it will change you. And I think a lot of times for the worst.
Yeah.
It gives you hubris. I mean, I cannot definitively prove that, you know. But that's, yeah. It's a personal belief that I have. But yeah. going back to American leadership, I mean, I definitely hear what you're saying in terms of how, you know, you can have a certain belief, even put it in rhetoric, and then do things that are contradictory while still genuinely believing in the rhetoric that yeah. you put out. I mean, again, we don't want to get too off topic from the yeah. war in Ukraine, but, you know, thinking about what's happening in Israel and Palestine,
yeah.
you know, you have, you know, the U.S. trying to broker a ceasefire, pressuring mm-hmm. Israel. We're trying to build a port to get yeah. access to aid into Palestine because Israel's not yeah. letting in any significant amount of aid. Yeah. But meanwhile, we are giving the arms to Israel that makes it possible for these war crimes and crimes against humanity to take place.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying I agree with you when you talk about the contradictions that leadership yeah. can have while genuinely believing what they say. But I think, you know, when it comes to the American leadership, I think there is a lot of lack of self-confidence, yeah. a lot of doubt in the moment. I think in the context of a failed war on terror, in some ways, I think it succeeded in that we don't have, you know, a lot of Islamic specifically terrorist attacks in the US anymore, yeah. specifically from the groups that we were going after at the beginning, Al-Qaeda. But, you know, obviously complete failure in Afghanistan, yeah. the Taliban came back, you know, nothing. And then Iraq, we created a failed state, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, Saddam, no fan at all, awful human being in person. Yeah. But it really seems, by all accounts, the country's worse off yeah. than before our invasion. And what I'm getting at is, I think for a lot of people, instead of sitting down and reflecting, okay, how did we make such enormous efforts? Like, doing a real yeah, deep self-critical analysis,
yeah.
I think a lot of us simply just picked up our ball and said, I'm going home now. Yeah. I don't want to play no more. I don't yeah. want to play no more. And I think that's part of the psychology that you see in some of this Republican you yeah. know, leadership, these people who are, you know, trying to stop Ukraine yeah. and saying it has nothing to do with us. I do think Biden, on a personal level, and you mentioned this in the paper, is strongly and confidently in yeah. support of Ukraine. But I will say, again, sticking to the topic, because we could go a million different ways yeah, with yeah. this, but I don't I don't really know if we really have a long-term vision for that region.
Yeah.
For whatever you want to call it, the post-Soviet space, for Russia's place in Europe. I do think a lot of it seems pretty reactive. You know, simply, okay, Russia is invading Ukraine, violating territorial sovereignty. We want to stop this. I'm doing everything I can to decisively stop this. I'm talking about Biden, Blinken. Of course, there's a whole lot of domestic political considerations, but oversimplification. But as to like what happens, you know, like, let's say, you know, Putin calls off the war tomorrow, which of course is not going to happen. But hypothetically, I don't see a clear vision. I don't see a clear vision. I think that's a major problem.
Yeah.
And I don't really know if Europe does either. Western Europe, whether it be Germany, France, the UK, in terms of, you know, how to treat, you know, these states and, you know, whether it be Baltic Europe or Black Sea Europe.
Or Russia.
I don't, it's very lazy thinking. I don't know. Because it seems like the predominant belief, I think especially here in Germany, was this idea that, you know, through trade and this and that, that the country would, Russia, would slowly liberalize. You know, Putin won't be here forever. And, you know, as they get wealthier, you know, they'll come around and slowly be like, oh, because of course they all knew what they were dealing with. You know, a dude who worked kind of in a mafia style, the assassinations in the UK.
But they also, like, you know, Germans, like, did trade with Russia, but only, like a specifically focusing on, like, you know, gas and resources, which is, like, you know, basically putting money into, like,
the war machine.
What became
the war machine. Well, again, I think that was the short side in the Soviet Union, because a lot of countries, you know, further east were warning them. Poland, the Baltics, you know, so, yes, but going back to American leadership, I definitely think there's a lack of vision and, you know, I don't know what the solution is, because I'll be real, I don't have the solution. I don't know what the vision is in terms of how to integrate Russia. Because I think, again, I brought that up because I do think the U.S. and Western Europe needs to think that through more thoroughly. But at the same time, I think, you know, Russians have the right to choose that for themselves. And that is also their burden, depending, or responsibility, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
And I'll be real with you, you know, as an outside observer, and again, I don't really know this much to argue about it, but like, y'all have failed at the moment.
Doing that. Yeah.
You know, your place, because this is where we at right now, and with a war that benefits nobody.
Yeah.
Don't benefit Russia either.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, he were to steamroll over Ukraine tomorrow and Zelensky were to capitulate.
Yeah. What?
The native population hates you. Yeah. Most of it, at the very least. Your economy is like on a complete war footing now.
Yeah.
All these dead men, all these traumatized men who are going to come back.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's a very pressing question, you know. What is the vision for Russia? And like I've asked you before, it's like, what you want to be? You just want to be like the West?
Yeah.
You just want to be like the West? What does that mean? And do you really want that in the context of
The things that have it.
This, like, democratic decline that's happening throughout the West? The neoliberal hegemony that we live through. Of course, you know, you could simply say, I like this. This is great. But I strongly disagree with you then.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's also, for me, it's interesting how it's almost, I mean, it's still, it has like this, you know, the whole idea that Russia is against the West. It also has like certain narratives that you take from the past, because I mean, Russia conceives of itself as a part of Europe. I mean, still, and you can see it like in all speeches, on, like, you know, whether it's Putin or Minister of Foreign Affairs or whatever, and they never think about themselves as like outside Europe. So they always like think about themselves as like, it's almost like it's like they're a better part of the West. You know what I mean? That's what kind of like their actual vision.
I do agree in terms of how they view themselves. It's like we're the West before y'all lost your way.
Yeah, because before, like, you went to the decline, so to speak.
Yeah, and now, because, you know, we're going to be talking about the genderless West.
Yes,
gay propaganda. Oh, we're going to shut that down. Yeah. You know, we're, and that's why, you know, I see in the U.S., in the context of the culture wars, you have people further to the right
who are
idolizing Russia pretty openly. Mm. You know, Tucker Carlson heading over there.
Oh, my God,
look at these shopping carts. You know, this and that, not challenging Putin on any of his falsehoods. So definitely, I agree with that. But you know, on that topic, I do want to ask you. I mean, do you not see Russia as Eurasian at all?
Yeah,
because a lot of it is in Asia.
I think Russian state
density is much more in the European part population. Yeah. But I mean, because that's something I think about too. You know, it's a lot of ethnicities there that are not European, and you never really see them get talked about too much besides the Chechens. Or I don't know. Yeah. I'm showing my ignorance right now. They're not European. Being in the Caucasus. Being in the Caucasus. Yeah. But I don't really see other ethnicities being represented at the highest levels of the Russian government.
I mean, let's see what ethnically it's like. I mean, I don't want to mess statistics, but it's probably 80% like overall population is ethnically Russian. Which even if you compare it to France nowadays, it's like statistically speaking, Russian population is way much more ethnically united, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it has to do more with this idea of still remnants of Russian Empire. Whether it's it was Soviet Union, now it's you can say it's new Russian Empire or new Soviet Union.
Yeah, he's definitely got imperial ambitions. He compared himself to Peter the Great.
Yeah, and they also play a lot with this idea of trying to be multicultural. Because there was no period when Russia just ended being empire and just became a nation state. Because Russia, if you think about it, it's probably 80% of people are ethnically Russian, right? It should be more or less just a nation state. You know what I mean? Nation state as France is a nation state
But then the next question is, who's part of the nation?
Yeah, and this is of course...
Are you going to have an inclusive mentality or an exclusive mentality? I mean, I think it's pretty apparent there's a lot of discrimination in Russia. As well, I mean, I look at the reaction to, there was that terrorist attack just the other month at the concert. And I think they were all from Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, I mean.
And now there's been a massive crackdown, it appears, on people from Kyrgyzstan at large. And there's a lot of temporary workers there. And it seems like there's kind of this blanket mentality of.
But this tension has always been there,
mm-hmm.
Between people from, especially Central Asia, coming to Russia. I mean, they're coming as migrants, right?
Yeah.
I mean, very often illegal migrants, so they don't have in Germany, because you can just cross the border easily. And it's obviously a problem. But again, what I try to think about is how Russian state utilizes this idea, so to speak, of Russia, as ethno-cultural nation for its own kind of purposes, so to speak. Because again, they don't really think about people living in Russia. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one in Kremlin thinks about people living in Russia.
The actual day-to-day quality of their life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what their actions show, so it makes sense.
I mean, I remember when I went to university in Russia, one of our professors, she argued openly that Russia cannot be democratic until it's separated into a couple of states, which is interesting.
In order to retain all that territory, it needs to have this strong centralized power that doesn't have much democratic.
And I guess to be more monolithic and more centered around certain regions, because again, it's just all about being able to control your own people who you elect, so to speak. I mean, Russia, of course, it's interesting because Russia based Russian constitution on American constitution. It's a copy paste, a lot of things were very, very copy paste. The funniest thing that when Putin became president in 2000, they had this rule in the US. You cannot be elected as you can be elected as a president only twice.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why he put Medvedev in.
Yeah, yeah, but right. but they didn't have on twice, just twice. Let's try it twice in a row.
he took a little break. He put his boy in, he doubled back.
Which is still
he don't even pretend no more though.
I mean, I have my own thoughts about the whole Medvedev thing. Because it was like Medvedev.
Well, he was a Democrat at the time. That's how he was.
He was like very openly Democrat, like, you know.
But then look at him now. I wonder how much of it was an act, though. Because we're talking about a massive shift now. Because he be saying the wild things sometimes. And then
you never know, like, maybe they hold his kids in the basement, you know? And like FSB.
Maybe, because that man and the Democrat, it don't line up. Because I feel like his role now is almost to say wild things.
But he's
and
not,
then it makes Putin look more moderate when Putin pulls back the leash.
Yeah, but he's one of those friends of Putin who was just a lawyer, like, you know,
it's not about a meritocracy.
Yeah, he's not from FSB or anything. So probably they all like eventually came from like had some connection to FSB, but like he's not like officially like a type of the person like from Siloviki class, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when you go to like this 2007, because they were like Medvedev, and I don't remember the name of the guy, but there was like another person who like everyone thought he gonna choose him, and there was like a typical Silovik, you know, kind of like a Putin person.
Mm-hmm.
He chose Medvedev, so you know maybe there was like a lot of signaling to the West again. Because look, you wanted change of government. Here's your change of government, like, you know, just, you know.
Yeah. And I'd like to look into how the West reacted to that at the time, because I'll be real, I don't know.
Yeah,
how much did the West buy that?
I mean, they always, like, I remember they had, like, those parodies that it's not real, of course, it's like they had, like, but, like, eventually, but you also, it's hard to envision, like, the change of government in Russia any other way, because even if it happens, it still happens, like, through this, like, elitist, you know, kind of, like, change of elites, so to speak. Like, oh, it's like a change in elites, within elites, but it can't be really democratic process in a country that doesn't have any real democratic institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, doesn't have any party system. Like, you know, it doesn't have any good parties. Like, you know, like, even if you want to vote, I mean, and if you want real democracy, it's like, there's also like a lot of voices in Russia. If you want real democracy in Russia, I mean, you know, good luck with that. They're probably going to choose like kind of new Adolf Hitler, like, you know, kind of like Prigozhin. That's like their candidate. You know,
yeah, he probably would have gotten a lot of votes if he was allowed to run.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And I mean, I actually think if I mean Prigozhin, I mean he's obviously dead now, but like if he were to run, yeah. But if he were to run, like he would have a good nationalist base, because I mean that's type of if you understand Russian psyche, you need to be like very kind of like this type of nationalist, almost like you know, there's a lot of like, I mean, people used to say it a lot before the war in Ukraine, that Putin is embodiment of like a lighter version of that.
Mm-hmm. But that's how he seems to view himself. I am the embodiment of the will of the Russian people.
Yeah, but like not like, you know, lighter, like, because it can go even darker, so to speak.
Yeah,
but, you know, obviously now it changed because of repressions and like, you know, all this kind of because they just like so many people just go to jail now for just posting something.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously sounds something like from that people like that we saw in like, you know, 1930s in Soviet Union.
Yeah, and this regression is scary.
Yeah,
but you know, going back to the rationalizations for the war, I do wonder what we can get from how the war itself is being waged in terms of, you know, its causes. Because the reality is with this war, there's genocidal rhetoric behind it.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, at the very least. You know, we're saying that the Ukrainian people don't really exist.
Yeah.
As Ukrainians, they don't really exist. And of course, you know, in the liberated occupied territories, you know, you have a lot of cases of torture, sexual assault, executions of people who are non-combatants. So, you know, with that in mind, I think it kind of goes back to why I do challenge you a bit in terms of centering NATO completely.
Yeah,
you know, this genocidal rhetoric, this irrationality.
Yeah.
You know, and the explanation for that, I'm entirely sure. I'm putting out questions that I don't have the answers to.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this links to Putin seeing a special Russian mission. You know, grandiose ideas, his isolation during COVID.
Yeah.
You know, because I definitely don't think that can be discounted. Because looking at this war, I don't see something that's entirely based in realist pragmatism.
Yeah.
You know, international theory.
what I think, I mean, always, like, you know, in every situation, like, multi-causal, like you kind of, like, when you have just one explanation, it's usually pretty flawed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to look at it from many perspectives. I mean, I think definitely that, I mean, I told you, like, I really believe that Putin got, like, you know, got, like, a Russian virus. He definitely believes in the idea of Russia. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes when he speaks, like, as Russia speaks through him. Like, you can see it, like, you know, because, like, and some people call him, like mad because of that. But it's, like, maybe there is something to the idea of a nation that is, like, really real. It's, like, yeah, we know that viruses are real, kind of. Like, why Russia is a virus cannot be a real thing. And again, like, coming back, like, when you put into this, like, you know, big palaces, you have so much power, you can go through from Moscow to Vladivostok, and you just try to in your brain just try to understand you rule this, like, lands, and you can collect those resources for your own, like, you know, do whatever you want with that.
I do think, you know, taking the context, he's in a KGB, man. He said, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union was what, the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century.
Catastrophe.
So, I mean, he's pretty open about his thinking in certain ways, but yeah, I don't know. When it comes to this war, it's obviously it's a tragedy. But, you know, thinking about how, you know, how some of these lands will even be reincorporated if they are liberated. You know, Crimea, for example. I mean, will the next government, even if it's more democratic, give it up willingly?
Yeah,
because I, you know. Well, we haven't really talked about it all at the moment. I guess because it wasn't the focus of talking about the causes, you know, if we're getting too off topic, stop me. But, you know, the reality is the war right now, Ukraine's on the back foot.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, speak beyond my knowledge because I'm not no military expert, nothing like that. Yeah. But, you know, just what I've been reading, it seems apparent. You know, Ukraine is steadily losing ground, not at like an extremely fast pace, but they are. Obviously, the summer offensive last year failed. You know, but a huge aid package has just been passed by the U.S. We'll see how that affects the progress. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, I wonder how Russia is reacting to this passing of this new aid package. If it's no effect at all, if it's weakening their resolve. I mean, I guess these are the type of things that, you know, they're probably not going to say publicly. You only have to guess at it. But
yeah, I think they chose, I think, like, I think they, when they announced that they're going to incorporate those territories, I think there was, like, a deliberate decision to play, like, a very long game. And I think whatever Putin is playing, he's playing just a long game.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's like everyone, like, they all understand, like, the problem won't be resolved in 1, 2, 3 years. It's probably something that we're going to lead through, like, 5, 10 years more.
Yeah, assuming the regime stays in power.
Yeah.
But then going back to their thinking, you know, is why I think it becomes clear that, you know, Putin thinks that the U.S., this democratic decline, which the West is absolutely experiencing, if you don't see it, you're in denial.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think he thinks that it's inevitable and it's happening at a pretty fast pace. I think he's banking on that, you know, for leaders like Marine Le Pen, Trump, you know, an IFB, an alternative for Deutschland to come into power, you know, these more inward-looking individuals, parties, and they'll let him, you know, do what he wants, or at least give him a real good deal. You know, I think he's absolutely banking on that, and I can see why he thinks that. I think he's mistaken in thinking that's an inevitable, assuming he does think that.
I think it's one part of calculation, but, like, for me, I guess, like, when the more I study, like, the actions of Russian government when Putin came to power, it's clearly that he's the type of person that likes to wait a lot, like, you know, I mean, because he can, like, and also it's like, in comparison to the West, he has all the power, like, he makes the decisions.
I mean, he done seen Bush,
Obama,
Trump, Biden. Yeah, so I mean, yeah, you know, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, he just waits, and he waits for developments. And then he acts, like, you know, and then he, when necessary, he acts, so to speak. So, of course, like, I think, you know, this conflict is with us for, like, probably at least 10 more years, if not more. And then, you know, it's...
I mean, if it's going to go 10, I mean, I don't know if Ukraine's going to have enough men at that point. This is the part where I'm kind of speaking out of my lane.
Yeah.
But just from what little knowledge I do have, you know, now we're trying to guess what's going to happen with the war. But I definitely agree. He's absolutely seeing a long game. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know, whatever breaks that happen in this war, it's just or, you know, negotiations. I think it's just a pause until he regains the strength to go further, or if he sees a weakness, a moment of weakness on Ukraine's part. You know, as long as that Zelensky regime is there, a regime that is firmly anti-allying with Russia, he clearly, I mean, seems unable to accept that. Yeah. I mean, he's shown that time and time again. I mean, I don't know if this is 100% proven true, but I feel strongly enough where I'm going to say it on this. I think Russia was behind the poisoning of Yushchenko.
In I mean,
and then the invasion of Crimea. And now the full scale invasion.
That's
it's a track record. It's a track record. So I.
And obviously the question is, it's like, I mean, because you also need to think, what is his end goal? Like, this is what I try to think a lot. Like, you know, what would be end goal? But like, the more I think about like Putin's end goal, and
I apologize. Let me let you finish.
The more I think about, it's basically his open negotiation with the West. Like, you know, I mean, negotiation through the means of war nowadays.
Yeah, war is diplomacy through other means, as the saying goes. Yeah, I think that's very plausible. I think what I would say is I think he really wants to usher in this multipolar era, like, definitively. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could maybe argue we're already there.
Yeah.
And I think we are, to an extent. I mean, it's kind of blurry lines where you want to draw it, but I definitely...
Of course, yeah.
The unipolar moment, I do think, is over. I think you can see that in the reaction to the war. I mean, you know, like, Africa's not all on the line with the West, you know, sanctions on Russia, this and that. You know, India is continuing to buy, I believe, Russian gas and oil still, or at least the oil, because they're getting it at discount prices, which is, you know, India had that leeway in 1991.
Yeah.
I doubt it. But going back to what I was going to say, is my point is, I think he wants to get into a situation. I really do. If he sees the moment is right, where he gets into the confrontation with NATO with the strong belief that the U.S. will not show up. And then if that happens, U.S. credibility is shattered.
Yeah.
And we are definitively in a multipolar era. Like, at that point, again, you could probably say we already are now. But at that point, it's like Russia's right there with the U.S. in some way. I mean, economically, it still would not even be close. But, you know, that would be a monumental event in the international system. And I think that's the confrontation that is, because open that this is not just about Ukraine. This is about with the West.
Yeah.
They're open. We are at war with the West. This is what I just saw. They put the vehicles out on display that they captured, some Abrams tanks, some German stuff that they sent over. So I think that's what he's looking for, which is why I do believe so strongly that the US and the rest of Europe should continue supporting Ukraine. Because I don't think he's going to stop. I really don't. I think the Baltics are next. I think he's going to challenge them for real. And of course, that's an extremely dangerous situation for the NATO, Russia. I think that could be Armageddon.
Yeah, for Europe in general. which is a very pessimistic scenario.
Yeah, but I mean, he's been open, you know, like what, you know, I think that is a big part of what he said at the Munich statement and whatever that was.
Yeah.
Kuwait. Where it's like, he was basically, the way I'm interpreting, he's basically like, you know, what right does the U.S. have to tell us, everybody else, what to do?
Yeah.
You know, I think he's continued to say that. And I think there are very valid reasons for saying that. But obviously, Putin's taken it to a way where he wants the U.S. spot.
Yeah, there's a lot of resentment. Yeah. That
trauma as well, from the collapse of an empire, I think, as well.
Yeah. But I mean, also... I guess it's like it's just not like, you can't really explain it through like one perspective, but like there's so many factors. I mean, mistakes of the US foreign policy, like, as well, contributed to it. I mean, and just like mistakes, and again, because I feel what the US is missing, and for me it's also like very surprising, not surprising, kind of like surprising to, like, just like, I want to understand what is missing in the US, like, diplomacy or just, you know, foreign policy apparatus, that they never really reflect on their own mistakes. And then they keep making the same mistakes, which leads to the situation when they kind of, again, they don't have a grand thinking. I mean, they kind of do in certain way, but this grand thinking just keeps making the same mistakes that led them to...
Yeah, that everyone thinks like us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because that was very, very apparent with, you know, the wars in Iraq.
Yeah.
And Afghanistan, especially Iraq, where, you know, this idea of universal values. Everybody thinks like us.
Yeah.
Everybody's gonna want democracy when we force feed it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe, you know, there was still a little bit of that when looking at Russia. And again, I just leave in the context of liberal international theory with the strong belief in international organizations and this idea that there's this path that you go on as you liberalize your economy, that democracy will come with it. With wealth comes democracy, which is clearly, I think, not true.
Yeah.
I think at the moment, so I think that might have played a part. But yeah, I mean, we've discussed, you know, off this pod about, you know, the fact that the U.S. gave a NATO guarantee to Ukraine and Georgia,
believe,
with no clear timeline. That was the worst of both worlds. Angering Russia, antagonizing Russia while simultaneously not guaranteeing security for either of those countries. And we see that. Georgia got invaded and lost a little bit of land. Ukraine has gotten invaded and lost a good chunk of land and, you know, may lose some more. Hopefully not. But
and they repeated the same in 2021. That's actually one of, like, my paper when I was doing research. I was like, wow, it's like they're just repeating the same mistake here. And they just, and for me, it was like, and I understand, like, you know, like Biden's administration is probably one of the best administrations that the U.S., I mean, in terms of like foreign policy, like with a good, like, you know.
Are you like, saying in history? You saying
not the history, time? But like in recent history. I mean, it's a solid.
All I see is a, maybe all I see is oversimplification, but I'm seeing a whole lot of mistakes. I mean, you see the war in Israel and Palestine right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Continuing to neglect the Palestinians' desired right to their own country.
Yeah.
You know, that's being occupied. You know, I think
that's a big conflict.
A big mistake. And also, I think, you know, there's been a lot of pressure for countries to choose between the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
You know, hey, don't let Huawei do stuff here, this and that, where countries are like, yo, China's a huge economy. Let me get some of this money, but not to get too off topic. But, you know, with Biden, and I'm actually someone who believes that Biden is a decent man, despite the fact that his administration and his actions are leading to these war. I mean, a whole series of long U.S. decisions have led to what's happened to Israel. Yeah. Past. I don't want to get too off topic, but it's relevant.
Yeah. He's professional, right?
He's professional, but I do think he is a decent man. I don't want to ramble about this, but I don't think he's scum, but what I totally think he lacks is an imagination.
Yeah.
This is a dude who's been in the political system for so damn long.
Yeah.
And I think he's got a box when it comes to his thinking, you know, definitely when it comes to sticking to the neoliberal playbook. But, you know, his conception of Russia, there's a short-sightedness to it. And that's where it goes back to, like, a lacking of vision.
Yeah.
And I guess it wasn't just him. You know, Obama didn't address it.
Yeah.
Bush didn't address it.
Yeah.
Clinton didn't really. I think it was just like, oh, they'll just become like the rest of Europe. I don't know what the assumption was. But Biden, I mean, there are some foreign policy things that are like, in terms of, you know, for example, his strong, decisive support for Ukraine. But I don't know. I wish I could explain to you why there's this lack of understanding with Russia. But
yeah, just missing them. Because I know, and again, for me, it's like, I don't buy this whole argument that they're just like cynical. Just like, again, just knowing American culture and just American people, even, it's like, again, it's, I just don't feel that this is a good argument just to argue that, like, yeah, just Americans are very cynical. I mean, it's also like a very monocausal explanation of all their actions. And like, to me, it's like, it really seems that it's almost like they're missing something in their thinking. And, you know, and it's almost this, like, this bothers them too. Like, you know, come on. Because, I mean, it's like, imagine having all the power in the world, being in this moment when, like, America basically, and still can decide, like, you know, the future of humanity for sure.
It's still the most powerful country in the world.
Yeah, I mean, clearly. No doubt. And it's also like a lot of leverage. And even talking about China, Russia, you never know how those systems, you know, going to like survive. But like there is, I mean, I bet like the U.S. going to survive more than Russia as a country. I mean,
okay.
I mean, you know, seriously, because
you said it, not me.
No, but not as a system, so to speak, because, you know, I like American system, like it's one of the most, like, is I mean, it has been with us for 300 years.
It has.
And it's still there.
Yeah. Like, you showing know. Some cracks, though.
Yeah, showing but some like. Cracks.
You want to get me started on that? I'm going to have to do another one if you want to get me started on that.
Yeah, we'll keep it for the next one. When there's going to be closer to election season, right?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it's still, what I'm trying to say, it's like for a long-term perspective. I still have more belief in like the continuity of the American system.
Yeah, in contrast to the Russian one.
Yeah, because you don't, you know, Chinese one, you know, China is also, because the state is a new state, you never know how it's going to play out, like in the 50 years even. Mm-hmm. But the American system, it seems it was, you know, stable through like last two centuries and it was fine. Mm-hmm. So it has like a mechanism to solve the problems and it keeps kind of like, updating itself almost, right? And like Russian system, it does not know how to update itself. It just it just keeps like, you know, making like the fatal error every time, going to revolution and then just starting all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And in Russian case, that's especially from people perspective, it's what leads to suffering, coming back to what the way we started the podcast.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, it's like if you owned anything in 80s or like whatever, even in when the time of the Dostoevsky, like, you know, it's all gone. Like, you know, you cannot even trace your relatives in Russia. It's so hard. You cannot know like who your relatives are, because like in Soviet Union, they just basically erased like this memory of people, because it was inappropriate to ask where did you come from? Like,
They want everybody to be equal.
Yeah.
But that was a lot.
Yeah. Which is, of course, it's like an animal farm, right? You know.
Yeah, everyone's equal. Some people are more equal than others. Yeah.
But eventually it led to, you know, to this kind of... and again, like, for example, in American culture, just like, sorry, bring the topic of the American culture once again. It's like you still think so much about the Civil War. Like, you know, as a...
It's still very conscious. I mean, I didn't see many people have, you know, American or Confederate flags on the back of their trucks. Yeah. So many times in my life to count. So yeah. I mean, it's there. I mean, it's, you know, their distortion of history. But yes, it is. It's present. We're taught about it in school. We're also taught a distorted history about it. I don't know. Because you have a point that I don't want to run off of. But yeah, well, the Civil War is present in our consciousness.
Yeah, it's part
of it. It's there.
But like Russian Civil War, which, you know, many more people died in Russian Civil War than in World War One from the Russian side. It's completely gone. Like we don't discuss it. It's because it's just like this kind of like missing understanding of like, yeah, like we just fought with each other just 100 years ago inside our own country for just like, you know.
Yeah, in a brutal war.
In a brutal war with like a mass, I mean, basically what created, you know, Stalin's system was like a civil war, because they started doing repressions, right?
That's where they got their practice.
Yeah. I mean, and then they just carried on, you know? And this is completely missing. So it's like there are so many demons in Russian society that it's just like, I mean, you could see like a lot of people arguing that like what is going on in Russia, it's already civil war, like inside Russia. Mm. It's like very repressed ones. And it's like, you know, I see this argument because like there is just, you know, no way to express it, but it's definitely there. Like the animosity like towards other people in Russia, it's very high. Okay. And the lack of kind of like, it's just the lack of community. Just Russian people hate each other most of the time. Yeah. Yeah. Coming back to suffering, you know. Okay, well, I guess we can, you know, finish it for today.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on. It's a good convo.
Thanks for coming. Well, we'll see you in the next episode.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, see you, man.